Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Award-winning performer, actor, and writer Eric Bogosian earned early acclaim in the 1980s for his in-your-face, one-man performances on stage and then on the big screen in talk radio. Tough, raunchy, trash-talking, brutally honest, inspired. These days, he plays Detective Danny Ross on TV's Law & Order, Criminal Intent, and he's back on the edge with his new semi-autobiographical novel, Perforated Heart. It's a double portrait of the artist as a 50-something man meeting his younger self, a self a lot like the young Eric Bogosian. This hour, On Point, Eric Bogosian on the rough arc of life. You can join the conversation. Are you a Bogosian fan? Have you seen talk radio? What happens to the rough fire of youth as we move on? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me in the studio is three-time Obie Award winner Eric Bogosian. He's just published his third novel, Perforated Heart. If you like Neil LaBute, Neil says, Bogosian was the first and remains the best at digging deep and fearlessly into the American male's heart of darkness. You want a more NPR kind of endorsement here? Sarah Vowell says, he has an entertaining knack for exposing the appalling yet hilarious way American men think. Eric Bogosian, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Tom. Great
that,
to be here.
Is that what you're still up to, the appalling aspects of American maledom?
Well, I will continue to look at the dark side of human nature as opposed to the sunny side, because I find the sunny side kind of boring, not worth really writing books about.
You've got an artist here, a writer. He's 56 or so in the book, and he, after some heart surgery, is recuperating out of New York City where he lives up in Connecticut, comes on his diaries from the 1970s. And the book cuts back and forth, 1977, 2006, back and forth all the way through. He's 56 years old, and he's looking back and really with kind of a big exercise of staring in some, what I don't know, fascination, a little bit of horror at the young man he was. 56, is that kind of early to be, you know, taking stock of life? I mean, when is it, when do you start to, you know, hear the curtain call and look back like it's a chapter last?
Well, I think it starts in your 50s for sure. I think that's when it starts to hit you. In my case, I've been thinking about these things, and I did find my journals. I found this carton with the stuff from when I was first got to New York, and I was, like the character talks about being appalled by how naive he was and what a dum-dum he was back in the mid-70s. Of course, that dum-dum is the guy who ended up writing all the good stuff that he's well known
that
for.
That made him famous. Mm-hmm.
But I think there's another factor that really makes a book good is that when you're in your 20s, you don't know how the story's going to end. And everything's very dramatic. The girl turns you down on a date. Maybe you're never going to have another date again for the rest of your life.
Right.
You know, your reading fell flat. You're going to be a failure as an artist. So you, in your 20s, it's a very dramatic time, and I thought that would make it a good story.
We're going to dive deep into those 20s and the New York of that time. It's your character Richard Morris's New York. It was in many ways your own as well. But give us a little reading, if you would, from Perforated Heart. This is this is where Richard Morris, the main character, is in his present in the book. This is in 2006. He's had some heart surgery. He's thinking about himself and life and the arc of life. Eric Bogosian, could you read a bit for us?
This is
Truth is
February 18th, 2006, according to the book. He's ruminating on what he's been reading. Truth is, I was never a great lover, possibly not even a good lover, average in every way, then and now. This is the meaning of anonymity, to be nothing special. The pain of this acknowledgement stirs me. I thought I was special, but I wasn't. I was only one among many. To acknowledge the anonymity of one's own effort, isn't that kind of a death? The non-specialness, total merging with the billions, one more molecule circling the sucking drain. Exactly that anticipation of nothingness, exactly that pain of awareness that goads me forward to keep writing, to assure myself that I am indeed something special. Rousseau said, I am not made like any of those I have seen. I venture to believe that I am not made like any of those who are in existence. Now I am. Now. Now I am unique. I wasn't then. Then I was a naive idiot, a wannabe. But because I was so certain of my existence, I existed. A mirage. Every life is an arc. Begin as an infant, die a corroded old soul. Everyone reaches an apogee at some point. I'm past that apogee now. I will never again be as smart as I was, as strong as I was, as attractive, as fast as I once was. Never. I'm losing day by day, and I have to lose. I have a lot to lose because I've had it all. The fame, the money, the women. No children. Could have had the children, I guess. But even if I did, dying alone would have been in the cards because, as an artist, I would have compelled them to hate me. That is what all great men do, so it's better they never existed and never knew me. Leon's going to get what he wants. I'll go back to the city and endure the charade. What choice do I have?
His agent will get what he wants.
Yeah.
Eric Bogosian reading there from Perforated Heart. The artist looking back on his youth, taking stock of where he is right now. Every life is an arc, he says. You write, Eric Bogosian. Is the arc rougher? Is it tougher? Is it more cutting for an artist? You've been there. You are there.
There's definitely a vulnerability. You're exposing yourself. You're putting yourself out there in the public eye, and you're taking your deepest feeling. Certainly as a writer. I can't say like for a musician or something. But,
well, yeah.
But as a writer, I'm putting it all out there. I think Fellini said, I pull my pants down and the audience either applauds or laughs. And at that kind of exposure, I think means there has to be some reason why somebody would do that. I mean, you have to be a little bit off balance and sort of constantly trying to regain balance. For me, it's by making the work. In fact, there's a moment in the book when the guy, he's feeling really bad about an ex-girlfriend and he doesn't know what to do with himself. And he ends up writing all day long. I mean, he just writes until he exhausts himself. And for me, that's kind of a panacea to write.
It was in his early life, as you portrayed here, it's sort of a no-boundaries thing. A lot of it is very sexual, very raunchy. He lives it, and it all hangs out there in his writing. How does give us a sense of how Richard Morris, the 56-year-old, looks back on his, Rabelaisian, or whatever you want to call it, youth?
Well, for me, the idea really struck me is, as I was reading my own real journals from my 20s, I thought, if this guy walked in the room right now, I wouldn't like this guy. If I had a daughter and she was dating this guy...
That young man, are you kidding me?
Yeah, forget it with this guy. Get him out of here.
Because?
Well, he has no control. He has no discipline. He has no methodology. He's doing all kinds of things that are extremely risky. The amount of drugs the guy takes in his 20s and his sexual activities and all of this is just like, you know, and also he's doing nothing constructive as far as the 56-year-old's concerned.
He writes back in those 1976, cocaine is an excellent drug, especially combined with pot and vodka. Oh!
Well, yeah, but the 26-year-old would argue, I have to explore. I have to learn. I have to learn everything. I have to take it all in. And that was definitely why I moved to New York in the mid-70s. It was a wild place, and I wanted to be part of it.
Throughout here, you're Armenian American,
right?
But you make your main character here, and you've done this before, Jewish American, and he has a kind of a Richard Morris, the character in Perforated Heart, the writer, famous, not maybe the tip top tier of fame, but up there. He's got almost kind of an obsession with Jewish writers in this country, Philip Roth, and their experience, comparing it to his like and unlike. First of all, why haven't you made your characters Armenian-American over the years? The brand is just not as well-known?
Well, I'm interested in archetypes, and the American Jewish writer, particularly Bello, Roth, these guys have made this part of they've woven the Jewish experience, the Jewish American experience, into their writing, and it brings in a particular sense of outsider mentality and a little bit of resentment seems to be in there somewhere. The Armenian experience is very similar in a lot of ways and different. I first started playing identifiably Jewish characters on film when I did Altman's The Caine Mutiny Court Martial, and that was about 20-something years ago. And I met Herman Wolk when I did the thing, and he gave me a book of his that he wrote called This Is My God, and I began to study Judaism. And as I've continued to play these characters who are identified as Jewish, I did so in a Woody Allen movie and other movies, I felt it was my responsibility to understand, because I was an altar boy when I was a kid. I'm like, I went to St. James Armenian Church in Watertown. So I, and the more I learn, the more I want to learn. I'm just fascinated by this culture, and I've been to Israel. I've been to Yad Vashem. I think it's just a huge story that needs. So I.
But,
you know,
do your Armenian relatives come up and say, Eric Bogosian, why don't you play Armenians in your books? What are you doing? Or are they, given how kind of a rough side it can be out there, are they just as happy that you give it to another gang?
Well, I've not had anybody say anything to me, but I will tell you that my next project is a very large Armenian project, and it will be I know it will be, anybody's concerned about me not fully embracing my Armenian roots, they will be satisfied with this book. I've already spent a year just doing research on it, and it's incredible. But that's another story for another time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with writer, actor, performer Eric Bogosian about the arc of life, young to old, in his new book, Perforated Heart. You may know him from his work on Law and Order, Criminal Intent, plays the character of Captain Danny Ross, a Jewish cop who runs the shop. Here he is from the show telling detectives Megan Wheeler, played by Julianne Nicholson, and Mike Logan, played by Chris North, how he wants them conducting an investigation.
You're sounding like this is personal, Logan.
It's not personal. I just can't stand the woman.
Yeah, and she knows it, which is why you're not going to talk to her.
Wait a minute, I'm primary on this case.
Yes, you are. But for the time being, Wheeler, you fly solo. Try your soft sell. You track down the witness the driver dug up.
There he is, Eric Bogosian as Captain Danny Ross, laying down the law in Law and Order, Criminal Intent. But in Perforated Heart, he's got a big view, much longer than any case right in front of him, from the days of youth to the days of right now. And Eric, we've got a lot of people already who want to talk with you about exactly this arc. Connor in Somerville, Massachusetts. Connor, are you young or old, sir?
Hi, I am. I'm here on the phone. I'm 26 years old and called in just because I felt like the story is almost speaking about me. I keep a journal, currently trying to make it as an artist, as a photographer, while working a full-time job. And just a couple days ago, I was writing in my journal saying, you know, I wonder how I'll look back on this time in my life right now in 25 years, because I'm devoting, you know, so much of my time and money to this photography and pursuing it. And if it doesn't work out, will it have been a waste? Will I better serve my time spent, you know, making connections, friendships, romances, all that other stuff?
How about that stuff you heard in Eric's reading, you know, from the older perspective, talking about, you could have had kids, should have. How do you look at all that, Connor? Are you ready to bring whatever, the mate into your life, or does your art not leave room for that?
Well, it's funny. It's almost like the art precludes that from happening in a way. you know, spending 9 to 5 at work and then so much time after that doing photography and on shoots, it's, you know, it's almost like I've consummated a decision to forego a social life, you know, in the pursuit of this other dream. And, yeah, you know, I don't think I'm ready right now to get married. In a way, I don't have the time. I couldn't settle down. You know, if I had a wife and kids, there's no way I could afford myself the time to work on my photography and develop that.
Let's take you to the guru. He's sitting right here. He's written the book. Eric Bogosian, here's the artist as a young man. You've written it from both ends. What do you say?
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, I wasn't able to jump into the arts until I stopped thinking about where it was all going to lead and just said to myself, hey, I'm 25 years old, I'm 24 years old, go for it, see what happens. And then when you're 30, if it doesn't work out, go get a real job. As it turned out, I decided to quit at 31. I said no mas, and then I had no skills to do any other job, and I had to stay in it anyway.
You can't get out.
I also want to say that this character in the book is has been rigidly single his whole life. He still fools around. He's in his 50s, and he's screwing around with everybody. That's not my story. At 27, I met a wonderful woman, Jo Bonney, from Australia, director today, and we got married in 2 months, and we've been married since. We have two kids, and if she hadn't been in my life, I wouldn't have been able to make my work, because I was so out of control that I was, as they say, a legend in my own mind. I wasn't I was ready to think about it all day and party all day, but I didn't want to actually get down and make the work. And she actually at one point said, I will, you know, I will support you while you try and get your stuff started.
A wife and two children for decades. So do you sit and wonder, coulda, woulda, shoulda, what I might have been if I hadn't had all that domestic stuff?
Is absolutely. In fact, it goes beyond that, because there's this character's a kind of a resentful, bitter guy. And I definitely have my moments when I'm checking out one of my colleagues, and I think to myself, this guy, he has all the time in the world. He has no kids.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have to be earning that extra bucks to pay for the school and the college.
He can still party like it's...
The partying... I actually think of kids as my substitute for partying at this point, but I...
Not everybody would buy that as the equivalent of partying.
It's healthier.
No doubt.
Sometimes it isn't. You don't get any sleep. You get less sleep with kids than you get partying.
Yeah. So if Connor... gets the whole family thing? He's going to look back in the '50s and say, "What's your advice?"
I think you got to embrace it all. You got to, because you don't know what's going to make your art work. You got to follow your own vibe and your thing. And if you want to have a great relationship with somebody, maybe you have to take some time off and just go off and climb a mountain or do whatever. Go exploring. You know? It's way too narrow. A lot of people, I mean, this notion you go to college, you learn how to be an artist, that's absurd.
Connor, thanks for your call. You say you were so out of control then. What do you mean?
Well, I had gotten to New York. I'd gotten a job down in Soho. I was a sort of an ex-actor guy and had been pulled into this visual arts world. And those guys were going to clubs every night. So I was – eventually I ended up, like the guy in the book, going to clubs constantly. There were all kinds of drugs moving through my life and my bloodstream. And I just didn't seem to be able to focus on what it is I wanted to be doing. I would get up late every day and I would sort of amble out into the New York sunshine and see what was going on out there. The city was so fascinating in those days. There were so many dynamics of the city was falling apart. So there were all kinds of criminals to watch and down and out people to watch. And I was watching them.
Give us a little sense on that, if you would, right out of the book, Eric, the new book, Perforated Heart. We've got a scene here where your guy, Richard Morris, is out with Jack, a fellow clubber party guy. Set us up and take us in, if you would.
Okay, they're in a...
1976,
and they're in a disco, one of these underground discos that used to open at like midnight, and were pretty crazy places. I got very messed up, but by dancing as hard as I could, I burnt the intoxication out of my veins. I was high in a totally physical way, and even though I didn't know one single soul in the whole magnificent place besides Jack, I was an essential part of this gigantic endeavor. The place is huge, like a bee in a swarm. The place was a hive, and we were bees on speed, going faster and faster and faster. I got thirsty and went looking for Jack and found him upstairs in the middle of a vast mezzanine overlooking the dance floor. He was lying on a kind of bed couch with someone, a woman. I approached him, all smiley, and then realized that Jack wasn't just with this woman. He was actually having sex with this woman, right there in the middle of everything, with people coming and going all around them. No one cared. Jack glanced at me sideways but kept pumping away. He didn't smile. Later on, Jack came dancing up beside me. The woman was gone. He didn't say anything about me seeing him. It was as if I had caught him eating a slice of pizza. Not worth mentioning. He disappeared a couple of more times and then hours later shouted into my ear, "Time to go home." We stepped out of the warehouse onto the street where pigeons pecked at the night's crumbs and spills. The sun was edging up over the rooftops. We made our way down Broadway as the tense workers flowed up from the subway entrances, ready for another day of boredom. Jack and I were like the invisible dead, seeing but unseen. We shambled east along Houston Street, thick-headed and semi-blind in the morning glare. Insomniatic winos burned scrap wood in iron barrels. Buses and cabs roared and honked and hissed. Everyone was on a mission to contribute to the new day. Jack tugged me into the doorway of a diner. We sat down at the counter and ordered fresh coffee and fresh donuts. What could be better than this? I was deliriously happy, like a jet-lagged tourist. Jack nodded toward a gaggle of girls dressed up in sequin blouses and tiny cut-off jeans, lots of eye makeup. I knew these were hookers, having a quick bite before heading home to shoot up drugs and hit the sack. One girl smiled at me. Flattered, I smiled back until Jack whispered into my ear, "She thinks you're a hustler."
Eric Vakosian reading from Perforated Heart and his 1976 All Over Again portrait there of this artist in this book as a young partying man. Let's get a call from Newport News, Virginia. Jason, you're on the air with Eric Bogosian.
Hi, yes, sir. Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Good. What do you know?
Well, I mean, it's kind of an interesting story for me, which I think is pretty dwarfed compared to the situation we're talking about. But I'm 24 years old, and literally 2 years ago, you know, I had just dropped out of a major university that I had had a scholarship for. And wasn't really going anywhere, didn't know what I was going to do, and I didn't really care. And now I'm in the position where I literally start my job this week as a property manager for a luxury apartment complex here. I'm finishing up school, and I'm engaged to be married, and she wants to have our first child within the next 2 years. And it's strange because I think this whole looking at things in retrospect phenomenon is exactly a phenomenon because it seems so organic and natural, the change that's going on in my life right now.
Jason, let me, did you party your way out of school, Jason?
I did party my way out of school, but I don't think that's exactly where the fault lied. I think it was more in the fact that I had no vision, I had no here and now necessity.
So are you think you're going to look back from 56 and be happy that you put on the band of gold and became a property manager and settled down, or are you going to look back and say, "Oh my gosh, what?"
You know, I don't think I could be happier, honestly. I think the whole exploration theme that you're talking about, this whole motif, you know, the fact that, you know, sometimes you just need to get out there and experience everything as is. I think that's a double-edged sword. Honestly, I think it is both necessary and self-destructive.
Yeah. Jason, thanks for reminding us of just that kind of turn. Eric, you've got a passage in the book when your guy, Richard Morris, says, "I'm at the apogee of my life. Everything that I ever looked forward to has either happened or I'm in it now, so it's all downhill from here. What am I supposed to do for excitement for the next 20 or so years? I can reminisce about the good old days, I guess. I can ponder death. I can write memoirs." How old is your character when he says that?
He's 56 or something.
So, yeah. So.
Well, I'll tell you, I think it, one of the things that really brought it home was a couple of years ago, I had my 35th, and we all go through this, the 35th high school reunion. And the 35th is a very particular one. And, you know, you can say that everything in your life is relative. Any particular moment is like some other one, except the difference is as you get older, you can look back and you can compare what you're doing now. Obviously, when you're 25, you can't compare with what you're doing when you're 56 because you don't know yet what you're going to be doing at 56. And you get in a situation where you're with all your high school buddies and it really hits you hard. Like, here it is. Here we all are. In fact, I've had even more profound experiences of that when my boys, who have now both gone off to college and gone, I look and I go, well, there was their childhood. Whatever ball games we were planning to go to, whatever camping trips or whatever we were planning to do, we've done it. It's done. There's not going to be any other opportunities to do it. Weirdly, I've ended up embracing the folks back in my hometown even more so since that reunion.
You know, I wanted to ask you, though, as I read this, I mean, everybody talks these days, the boomers never want to think of themselves as old, never want to be old, but, the clock is ruthless. All this stuff about, 50 is the new 30 and 60 is the new 40. I don't know what. When do you think it's time to start looking back? Is there a time when it's too early? It's kind of undeserved nostalgia. Is there a time when it's too late to take stock? You know, you're denying the actual aging process. You're denying the perspective that you're getting trying to be forever young.
I think for me, I mean, if you're asking me what's happening with me personally, as opposed to Richard Morris in the book, I think for me it's a lot of baggage to toss overboard now. And I think it's a natural tendency to do this in my mid-50s, but it's not a place I want to be at. I had the pleasure of knowing Brother Theodore, who you may or may not know who he was, but he was this great performer in New York, lived to be in his 90s. And he said to me when he was 92, he said, "I'd give anything to have the sex drive I had when I was 83. And I think that you can't get all wrapped up in this stuff because then you're wasting your time.
Yeah, because you're alive right now, whatever the number is.
And I'm active. And I would love to be, when I'm 90, I'm going to look at 50s and go, what, I wasted all my time worrying about how old I was? I was a kid.
I mean, I know your protagonist has had heart surgery here, but I found him kind of mopey for 56.
He's a mopey, bitter guy. He's an angry guy. He's not based on me. He's got parts of me in there, but he's also based on a number of authors I know and know of who.
He says, there are two things in this world that cheer me up. He's 56. My library and my money. Oh, bring on the cobwebs. But what, this is your author friends?
One of the things, in a broader sense, that we're focusing on one aspect of his personality, but there are many others. He's quite a vicious guy, too. I was interested in looking at the fact that some of the great writers, or writers who aspire to be great and conveying wisdom in their writing, are often very petty and jerky kind of guys. I mean, even my countryman, William Saroyan, who was, he was this beloved guy in the 1940s, one of the most beloved Americans who ever was, wrote this sentimental stuff. And in real life, he was a gambling, hard-drinking guy who ruined his life with his habits. I don't know people like Naipaul personally. I don't know the man. I just know the biographies, at least two of which claim that given the fact he's a Nobel Prize winner in literature, in real life, he's considered to be not a nice guy to be around. So.
Is there something about being an artist that makes a person, a man, a jerk?
Well, no. I mean, this is the question that you got to put into that. That's my big question of the book. I think it's one of the big questions because I struggle with it myself. I mean, is there
being
such
a jerk or
no? The thing of
I ask it sympathetically because you're supposed to break boundaries, and conventional society often looks at that as being a jerk.
Well, or a certain degree of selfishness is necessary in order to pursue the goal of making great art. So, in other words, I can't be denied. I need this time. I can't be with the kids today.
Leave me alone.
I need the 12 hours to finish this edit or whatever I'm doing. So, you don't have to just talk about artists. You can talk about everybody. Is the successful life? Who's the good person? Who's the person? We now have this new term in our society: codependent people, people who do too much for everybody else, and maybe in some way are shortchanging themselves in their lives. So. What is it? At what degree are you being selfish, and at what degree are you being, taking care of your priorities?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with writer, actor, performer Eric Bogosian about the arc of life, young to old, and his new book, Perforated Heart. You may know him from talk radio. He played first in a one-man show and then in the film directed by Oliver Stone, the misanthropic character Barry Champlain, the talk radio host who hurls abuse at his listeners. Champlain has a kind of passing resemblance to Richard Morris, the main character in his new novel, I'd say. Both need an audience they can't seem to respect. Here's Bogosian as Champlain, the talk radio host in talk radio, building up ahead of steam.
I mean, who the hell are you anyways, you audience? You're on me every night like a pack of wolves because you can't stand facing what you are and what you've made. Yes, the world is a terrible place. Yes, cancer and garbage disposals will get you. Yes, a war is coming. Yes, the world is shut to hell and you're all goners. Everything's screwed up and you like it that way, don't you? You're fascinated by the gory details. You're mesmerized by your own fear. You revel in floods, car accidents, unstoppable diseases.
And he's just getting started. There's Eric Bogosian in Talk Radio. Lee Schreiber, of course, brought it back on Broadway recently. It's been a big hit yet again. Let's get a call from Salt Lake City, Utah, and Verna. Hi, Verna. You're on the air with Eric Bogosian.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a quick comment, and maybe this just kind of will, just from a different perspective. I'm divorced from an artist, and we have two little sons together, and I think, you know, for him, what he cares about most in his life is his art and our two sons. And I think that, you know, a big part of our divorce probably was just, you know, time-wise or just effort-wise, that was where his focus was. And, you know, we're the best of friends now. We get along well. It wasn't an ugly divorce, but it was just where we would always joke about his art that it was his mistress and, you know, that it was his passion, it continues to be.
And you've got two little children, you say, and you're not bitter, are you sure, Verna?
I'm sad. But...
You've got a sympathetic audience in Eric Bogosian. I mean, his art was his mistress, he's lost her, the family's, you know, dealing with that.
One of my first conversations with my wife, Jo Bonney, when I first met her, and we have had many, many conversations about art. She's a director of repute, and we've worked together on pieces. But one of the first things we ever talked about was kids, and I knew that I wanted to be with her because of kids. I made decisions regarding my acting career when I started getting better known after talk radio, to not be on location all the time. I had a little boy at home, and then another one was coming. And that's just my own personal thing. I mean, children are very important to me, and I wanted to spend time with them. It did mean I had to work harder. I mean, it meant that pretty much it was kids or work, and there wasn't any, like, extra stuff going on in my life. That was that's what I've done for the last 20-something years, and I'm totally happy about that. I guess for me, some deeper questions, and you mentioned how Barry Champlain is like something
radio.
Like this guy in talk radio, is that guys who engage in discourse, a public discourse, like Barry, a talk radio guy, like, let's say, Rush Limbaugh, who has very strong evidence of the guy's drug addict or he was convicted or something.
Yes,
he was. He's talking about things that are important to people, but what's going on in his life. Likewise, these guys, somebody's writing literature, books that we're meant to look at for guidance or wisdom about life. I mean, isn't this what literary fiction's all about? Then you can say, well, what's going on in this guy's life? Again, I'm not saying the jury's out for me whether Philip Roth has something to say about my life, given that he's never, as far as I know, he doesn't have kids or isn't married.
So the jury's really out? That's interesting. He's a great literary figure. Americans of all stripes have read him for years now.
I love his work. I love his work. I love Naipaul's work. Mm-hmm. I love Coetzee's work. These guys are great writers. Mm-hmm. And in them and through their art, mm-hmm. I learn about things that I want to learn about life. It's a toughie. And it isn't just artists. You know, you could look at a surgeon, a great surgeon, or you could look at a politician who dedicates huge amounts of time. Clearly, public image is different than the private image in the world we live in today. For me, this is something worth taking a look at, and I'm trying to do it in an entertaining way. I mean, the guy
and
is a rascal, and mm-hmm. he does a lot of rascally things throughout the whole book.
Verna, there with the loss. But good luck, Verna. You'll make it. You'll be all right. You remind us that Richard Morris, the 56-year-old, looking back on his 20-something self and perforated heart, has been vicious. Give us a sense of that side of this character's life.
How he's been vicious?
Let us count the ways.
Well, his main thing is he says it at one point. He has a very selective memory. If he does something wrong to somebody, he just forgets that he even did it. And there's a huge there are a couple of big revelations.
How nice for him, huh?
Yeah. Later in the book where he meets up with two women who were both very important to him when he was in his 20s. One was his roommate who, as far as he remembers, he had a couple of casual sexual encounters with, but he doesn't remember anything more than that. She lets him know what the truth was when he finds her again in Poland, where she's now moved to. Also, a woman that he was completely hung up on and totally worshipped, and he has a run-in with her later, and, well, I don't want to give it all away, but he... The guy,
he's taking liberties.
I write from character. Okay, I write. What do you say on my TV network? They say characters welcome, and I start with character. I start out as an actor, so I start out writing a character. All I know is the truth of the character, and I let the story unfold. I don't say to myself, "Oh, I want to have a moral in this by the end of it, or there's a lesson to be learned." I'm just going to go find out. What has Richard Morris got to do today? I think it's interesting that people sometimes say, oh, this is your story or this is you. And it's like, well, hey, look, if that helps sell books, fine, think that.
He does. You've got him saying in here, the affable artist is the bad artist. Only the ornery artist is the good artist. Jack, in Watertown, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Eric Bogosian.
Hello, how are you?
Okay. Hi.
I'm a new big fan of Eric Bogosian. I'm going to run out and get the book. But I wanted to relate a couple of things that really struck a chord with me. First of all, I'm originally from New York, and you were reading the passage about the warehouse-like disco, and I know we were in the same place. It was Infinity's, I think.
That's it.
Downtown. And
wow.
I spent many a night there going home on autopilot. And I'm sure
you know it well, Jack. Yeah, okay, so you partied a little bit. It sounds familiar to you. And then?
I did. And then I moved to North Carolina to pursue my interest in television production. I, too, had dreams of being an artist. Ended up meeting my now former wife, who was really an artist, a really good graphic designer. And I really struggled with, getting my own sort of artistic abilities out and really sort of cowered in her shadow for a while until we got divorced. And today I'm driving a cab right now and pursuing a master's in social work. So I guess you might say, in terms of your discussion, I'm trying to extend the arc a little bit at 53 years old, still kind of looking for myself, my place in the world, reflecting back on a life that didn't quite turn out the way I wanted it to, and still taking a stab at it.
You never know what's around that next corner. That is very true. And when you were back in the club, may not have pictured where it is right now, but then it ain't over. Jack, thanks very much for that. Let's get one more. Charleston, South Carolina. Chris, you're on the air with Eric Bogosian.
Hi, Tom. Yes, it's an honor to speak to a hero of mine. And I was wondering, as somebody who's a fan of, definitely, especially your early work, the monologues, Suburbia, talk radio, one of the things I've noticed is that you really explore the theme of disillusionment and how it manifests in people's lives and people's work and people's relationships. And I was wondering, now to excuse the cliche, but for people of my generation, you're an American theater icon, how your perspective has changed and if you're looking at disillusionment in a different way.
Bogosian.
Well, disillusionment might be some kind of form of resentment or anger. I don't know, but I know what you mean by it, and it's definitely part of the story in this book. What I think the big question is, which would be an Aristotelian question, is that starting from within the person? Are they looking to be angry or blaming others or be the disillusionment was assumed like the whole universe is letting me down in a way. This guy, I knew that when I wrote this book, it was fine to have all these journal entries, but I had to show in the arc of the young man how he ends up starting to become the bitter guy, the kind of pissed off guy that he becomes when he gets older. And one of the ways it happens is a disillusionment thing, which I kind of experienced when I got to New York, which was, I'm going to come out and make great work, and they're going to have parades down Broadway for me because they're going to love what I do. Well, the critic walks out after 4 minutes, doesn't even give me a chance to see the work that I'm doing. And this guy wants some kind of sexual favor in exchange for writing a review. And I'm like, wow, I don't like the way this works at all. And, okay, they want to play hardball. I'll play hardball back with them. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an option, and I don't know to what degree I did that or didn't. But The question I'm just asking is it, does it start inside you? Could mm-hmm. you approach the world in a more open way? Or does somebody have a chip on their shoulder to start? And I'm not, again, I'm not answering it. It's all part of this meditation in this book. But I'm thank you for bringing up disillusionment, because I think that's a big motivating force in terms of what you then decide what you're going to do in the future.
And whether we bring it or find it.
Yeah.
Deborah in Boston, you're on the air with Eric Bogosian.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Eric. I am 56, and I did go through that scene that you're talking about in the 70s and the 80s in Boston and New York, the rock and the art scene, which I found incredibly magnetic and also inspiring to my own work. I was a photographer at the time. And yet it got so intense with drugs and, you know, easy sex and all that, that I felt like I escaped under a barbed wire fence when I married my husband, who was completely different. And I was ready for that. And since I've had a child who's now gone off to college, and I sort of feel like now things are opening up and I have a chance to do what creative or different things that I can do. And yet the disillusionment is like nipping at my heels, like, is it too late?
And how do you look back on that those wild nights that you escaped by the skin of your barbed wire and teeth now, Deborah?
How do I look back on it?
Yeah.
I wouldn't change it, because I feel like I learned a lot. We did lose some friends along the way to various dangers. But I will tell you, having a 19-year-old son who just got a tattoo, how I felt was almost like how my mother would have felt if I had done it. And I'm finding that with the things that he wants to do, I have to let go.
The wheel turns.
That is the big question of, that was what started this book for me. He walks in the door and he says, I want a tattoo. And you go, over my dead body. And you go, wait a minute, how did I get
Who's
here?
Who's saying that? Who am I? Yeah. What? Yeah, yeah. Deborah, thanks for reminding us of that intensity. One more right here from Lloyd in Waltham, Massachusetts. Lloyd, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Well.
Good. I was really, the open piece, the novel that Eric read, really resonated with me quite a bit. And I was thinking about, I'm a writer who does a lot of profiles and interviews with musicians and some authors, and I'm always fascinated when people have some degree of success, say in their 20s, and then continue to create, and the work doesn't have the same kind of resonance in their 40s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, etc. And I'd mention, for a really popular example, say William Burroughs, who everybody thinks of Naked Lunch, but he wrote some really fascinating books in his 70s and 80s. People go to see the Rolling Stones. As big as they are, they want to hear the old stuff.
Yeah.
They, you know, even though the new stuff is frequently quite interesting in a different way. Or Beckett, people think of Waiting for Godot. They don't necessarily read the more minimalist later stuff. And this is a question that has always kind of fascinated me, and how artists deal with that. And I just turned 50 myself, and looking at my own work, and how, you know what I mean? And I just wanted to get some reflections.
And Eric is right there, of course. You write it. You've got Richard Moore saying in here again, every life is an arc, begin as an infant, die as a corroded old soul. Everyone reaches an apogee at some point. You've got him saying, I'm past that apogee now. I will never be as smart as I was. Never. I'm losing day by day. What about working as an artist on the other side?
Maybe, well, I think, you know, obviously when we talk about success in the arts, a big part of it is the audience reception to certain pieces. And when you're a young artist and you get a great reception to something, you've sort of been fumbling around for a number of years, whatever, and all of a sudden, here's this thing, and wow, everybody loves this thing. Well, I want to do more of this thing. Death for an artist to do that. You can't repeat those successes. I try very hard to continue to amuse myself and to amuse my friends. And sometimes things play out. I did the solos for 20 years mm-hmm. off Broadway, and then I was done. I didn't need to do them anymore. I write books. I don't know if anybody's going to, you know, embrace the books the way the solos or way talk mm-hmm. radio or something, some acting things I've done have been embraced. But I love I put everything I can into this, because ultimately, making this work is a manifestation of myself. It's me living today. This is the hardest thing. If I were a mountain climber, I'd be looking for new mountains to climb, and that's how I find out who I am day to day. So this is a challenge for me. I mean, this is my third novel, but I don't know. I'm doing the best I can as a prose writer.
There's a moment where your character, Richard Morris, says, you know, the only ones who are remembered when you, never mind your youth, never mind your middle age, your old age, but just look on out, look down the road, the only ones who are remembered in this world, kings, criminals, and artists, if I remember that correctly.
That's right.
Kings, criminals, and artists. I'd never quite seen that triplet before. It's wonderful. And you're not a king. I don't know if you're a criminal. Maybe in the old days, like everybody else, and now an artist.
I don't even know what's going to happen in terms of any sort of sense of remembering what was happening 50 years ago, 20 years in the arts, because we seem to be going into shorter and shorter attention spans. I think probably there'll be some guy working in some new mode that we don't even know about yet.
15 seconds beeping off that one, guys.
Yeah, it'll be coming in on your phone, and it'll be this great. I mean, we're waiting for the Quentin Tarantino of the iPod is going to show up, and that'll be. So.
Yeah, well, it's been a great career so far, and it's been fun through your fiction to look back and from kind of 56 to 20, you name it. The new book is Perforated Heart, and we really appreciate your work all the way along the line and in this new novel. Eric Boghossian, it's been great. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Thomas. It was wild.
Great to have you. Listeners, you can join the conversation, continue it online, and get our podcast at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.